The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So today Gavin Williamson, the Education Secretary, gave us a look ahead to what exams will look like this summer. Katie, can you tell us what he announced?
Yes, so after the horror show that was the algorithm last summer, we have a situation where Gavin Williamson has said that all A-level grades this year and exam grades are going to be done by teacher assessment, and that would be teacher assessment risks and looking at various factors in that and coming up with grades. And I think that this has broadly been accepted as the idea is there's no perfect solution if you cannot have children A in school but two sitting exams as to what you do about fairness in grades. So I think this generally seems to be seen as the least worst option, but that's not to say it's without problems, and we've been starting to hear some of the concerns over A, the practicalities of doing this, and two, the flaws in the system.
James, you've written on Coffee House today about one flaw that you foresee. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so if you think about it, for all sorts of understandable reasons, teachers are going to give their pupils the benefit of a doubt when it comes to potentially life-changing marks. For that reason, this year's results are going to be very generous. There's going to be quite a lot of grade inflation in the system. Now, think about the lower sixth, right? People sitting their A-levels next summer. They are going to be competing for university places and jobs against people who've had these teacher-assessed grades. So if they are subject to a normal, rigorous exam marked in the standard way, they will be put at a huge disadvantage. Now, this disadvantage is so obvious that the government is going to have to do something about it. To my mind, it is obvious that next year's A-levels are going to have to be marked much more liberally than 2019's A-levels would have been, to try and minimise the difference between what is happening to the class of 2021 and the class of 2022. So for this reason, I mean, this grade inflation is going to take 2 to 3 years to wash through the system. It's just a reminder that the after effects of this crisis are going to go on for quite some time.
Katie, today we're hearing the Labour Party's Kate Green, Shadow Education Secretary, saying that this is too late. Is that a good attack line on clearly what is a policy that is different to something she criticised last year?
It's quite, I find it quite a boring attack line, to be honest, if I'm just being completely honest. Is it too late? Kate Green's point is that clarity earlier on is good for everyone. It makes people less anxious. There's more time to prepare. There's more time to work through the system. But there's still lots of time ahead of this. And I think, to be honest, it just leans, from a Labour's perspective, into this idea that this constructive opposition that Keir Starmer and his shadow cabinet say they want to offer can at times feel like it doesn't have too much bite, but it's also a little bit opportunistic. So you find a problem in something which broadly it seems Labour does not have a massive problem with this as a policy. They agree with it as an approach, but yet they found a little thing to niggle at. And it touches on with this idea when you've had Keir Starmer say a week or two before Boris Johnson does something, you should do this. And it's already very clear that this is the direction the government's going in. So, I mean, I think it's something to say. Do I think it set the debate alight today? No, we're probably one of a very small group talking about Kate Green's intervention.
Given the view that the disparity in the provision of distance learning meant exams were impossible this year, given how wrong the algorithm went last year, you were clearly going to end up with these teacher-assessed grades. But I do think they put teachers in very difficult positions. Teachers now, essentially, are determining children's futures with, you know, a flick of their pen, you know. And if you're a teacher, you'll be a very hard-minded person if you took all your pupils who sit on the grade boundaries and didn't think that you would tip them to the positive side of that boundary rather than the negative side of that boundary. And that phenomenon alone is going to create quite a bit of grade inflation.
And James, is there a private state dimension to this as well, in that private school teachers were always better at gaming the system when it came to grades and predicted grades? So are they going to be more likely to mark their kids up?
But there's probably also elements of a kind of pushy parent syndrome, you know, which is, you know, those people who push and say hard and say, oh, look, this is proof that my child should be recommended for an A. And I think this is difficult. I also think it's difficult because your question actually, Cindy, can almost reveal something, which is lots of teachers, as they put the entries into the system, will be thinking, yeah, is it fair on my pupils for me to be marking harshly when I think that that school down the road, they're going to be predicting everyone straight A's come what may. And I think this is, you know, this situation is going to run into difficulties. Now, obviously, it would raise all sorts of red flags, you know, if schools were predicting every single one of their pupils' top marks. I don't think you'll see that. But I think you definitely will see quite a considerable amount of grade inflation. And that means that, to be fair on next year's students, those A-levels are going to have to be marked much more liberally. You know, this is going to take a long time to get back to the kind of marking system that you saw in 2019.
Katie, also today is the ratcheting down of the COVID risk level from level 5 to level 4. I've kind of forgotten what these risk levels mean. Is this the Nando's spice chart that we had last summer, spring?
So on the risk level, what this means is the fact it's gone 5 to 4 is this idea that at the moment there is not an imminent threat that hospitals and so forth are going to be overwhelmed. So I think it shows you that with this drop in cases, we're moving away from that scenario, which was only really a couple of weeks ago, maybe several weeks ago, when you had warnings from hospitals about the fact they really weren't sure if they would be able to let more patients in, but yet more patients were coming. Those photos of ambulances queuing up outside of them. So I think this is obviously an encouraging sign. I think what's interesting is that as it has been announced, we have seen government figures come out and say, guys, stay cautious. So I think it taps into a concern that on the week that we've had a roadmap, which has talked about freedom, but in the medium term distance, but still the idea that things are going to get a lot better, and also the fact the threat level's going down, I think there is a concern that people might just drop their guard and perhaps relax too soon. And ultimately is a long slog to get to that point on, you know, the late June, where we can allegedly do quite a lot of things again that we haven't been able to do for, by that point, for over a year. But if you think about the initial easing, we have next month the return of pupils to schools and the treat of being able to meet someone outdoors, not just for exercise. You can actually stand still, you can sit down. I think a lot of people are doing this already to a degree, but ultimately, is that going to be enough, or are people going to start pushing it a bit further? And I think that could be a challenge for some of the early stages of this roadmap, in a way that I would imagine by the time you get to the third part, because you can go out and do so much, they're in a way maybe quite a lot less rule breaking, because yes, you could do more in a month's time, but there is quite a lot to be doing. Whereas I think actually this point where nothing is really changing for several weeks could be one of the trickiest.
James, how mindful is the government of this potential fall in compliance, this people feeling like the light is almost here and so we can start relaxing now? Because I think in my essential work trips, when I get on the tube, I'm definitely seeing a lot more old people than I did before.
I think the government is worried about this. You can see this from the fact that that new TV advert basically saying, come on, please, keep going. You know, all these ads that you now see as you make your essential journey saying, you know, every covered face makes a difference. They're trying to keep everyone going through this. And I think there is it is going to be more difficult, I think, to maintain compliance as more people are vaccinated, especially as the news comes through about how effective these vaccines are in preventing serious disease. People will feel a bit more like confident. And you look, read through this roadmap, and it comes up with a date on which, you know, guidance on hugging will be produced. I suspect that when lots of grandparents who have barely seen their grandchildren because of this pandemic, you know, when on March 29th, you know, they are allowed to go and have their grandchildren in their own garden, I think a few people find it very hard to obey the rules that they shouldn't give their grandkids a hug. And I think that is going to go on. I think you can see the government trying to kind of keep people patient. But I mean, I write about this in my Common Magazine this week. Tory libertarians have been constantly surprised at how popular lockdown has been, how public support has maintained. They think that as the vaccination numbers continue and therefore the deaths begin to, and you are beginning to see it start to really fall quite dramatically and diverge from cases, but that's when public support for the restrictions will begin to fall away. And I think you can see the government's concern about this in the fact that this reopening plan really quite strikingly prioritises socialising over the economy. Note, for example, that you can have people around for a drink in your garden before you can drink in a pub garden. And that is a big contrast with last autumn, when the tier system essentially said, deprioritise what you might call non-economic socialising. People who wanted to see anyone indoors, which at that time of year I think was probably the more popular method of socialising, had to go to a paying venue to do it. You weren't able to do it in your own home. And I think it is a sign of a recognition of a kind of emotional toll that this long winter lockdown has taken, but they've chosen to prioritise social contact over the economy.
And Katie, I hear that the European Football Championship could be held in the UK this year. That means very little to me, but assuming that means a lot to some other people, how important is it?
Yeah, I'm not going to go deep into my football knowledge here, though I did start supporting a team this lockdown. Details for another time as a way to get through lockdown when nothing was on. But anyway, ultimately, the report suggesting that the UK could host all of Euro 2020, the rescheduled 2020, because the UK is so far ahead of its vaccination programme compared to European countries, that this could happen here because it would be simpler. And I think that were this to go ahead, it would be an interesting way of A, making the country feel as though it's opened up probably quicker than it has. But two, I think it touches on something else, which is one of the concerns about the slow pace of this roadmap is that there are lots of figures, including business figures, I'm not just talking about Tory MPs, who felt that the vaccination programme, the success there, would give the UK a head start on other European countries in terms of opening up, and that would give the UK an economic advantage. As it turns out, under this scheme, we don't know exact plans for the roadmaps of other countries, but I think most people think, well, not doing a big bang opening in April or May. So there is perhaps a missed opportunity, but obviously there's health risks. And I think that if you did do something like this and it worked out, it would provide loads of people with the sense that actually we have got an economic advantage from the fact we've had a fast vaccination program and a way out. So I think that if it does come together, and at the moment it's just reports, it would be a positive thing. And also we all know that Boris Johnson obviously thinks very fondly of his Olympic days. So I think any mass sporting events will give him a boost and a sense to play that back.
And James, in Northern Irish news, the unionists are taking legal action against the Northern Ireland Protocol. But what's new today is that the ERG, the European Research Group within the Conservative Party, who we haven't talked about too much recently, are joining their legal action. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, and Arlene Foster is saying it's time for the UK government to act unilaterally. I think there's an interesting question about how best to approach this. The ERG argument is just scrap the protocol. I think that approach is unlikely to get that far with Brussels. And obviously for the UK to scrap the protocol, having signed it itself, would have consequences of its international reputation. Relations with the Biden White House, I think, have got off to a much better start than anyone expected. I think given Biden's own personal interest in the Northern Ireland peace process and the question of the Irish border, unilaterally scrapping the protocol would not help that. So the question becomes then, how do you best persuade the EU to make some changes to the protocol and to get the EU off the legalistic position that, you know, these commitments and these checks are in the documents that you sign, so please stop complaining. I personally think the best argument is, look, the justification for the protocol was that it was about trying to square the circle of protecting the peace process and the single market and the integrity of the single market. And so if this protocol risks collapsing power sharing in Northern Ireland, which I think there is a decent chance that it does, because if the DUP get nothing on it, will they stay in government? You know, they've already decided to boycott all kind of north-south dialogue over the protocol. You know, and saying to the EU, look, you know, that is the case for changes. And trying to build a coalition with the Irish government on this to try and persuade EU countries that it is worth some changes to the protocol to ensure that it doesn't impinge as much as it is currently doing on the everyday life of people in Northern Ireland. I mean, Micheál Martin, you know, when his comments that, you know, various EU countries need to cool it in their attitudes to the protocol, suggests that the Irish would be kind of willing to be kind of helpful on that kind of approach.
Katie, how influential a force is the ERG in the Conservative Party and in Parliament now that Brexit has happened? And as James says, they did vote for this deal. So how powerful is a call like this?
I think anything with a research group in gives the government a headache, and the European Research Group is seen as the original there. In terms of backbench pressure, I think clearly it can add to the sense of urgency for the government to look at something, but ultimately, I think the government is acutely aware of the difficult situation it is in and the fact it needs to do something about it. Boris Johnson has talked about activating Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol. He did that at Prime Minister's Questions, but I get the sense that in the EU and the Irish government, they do see that as an empty threat. So something would have to change for it to seem imminent. It does feel as though the government have walked back from that since then. You have Michael Gove trying to engage in constructive talks. I think what's interesting is last week we saw David Frost join the cabinet and he now has a role overseeing this. So as of next month, he'll be the person looking after these talks. And I think that we could see a shift in tone because generally speaking, Michael Gove is seen to want a more diplomatic, softer, let's work together approach. Whereas David Frost is to, and obviously all these distinctions can be too simplistic, but David Frost is more combative and a more aggressive approach. So there could be a shift in tone that might go more towards the ERG thinking, though I don't think anyone would go so far as to say David Frost wants to rip it up completely. I think when it comes to the various issues of the union, there's some other interesting things happening. So one thing that I reveal in this week's cover story is when it comes to union strategy, there's now going to be a new cabinet committee. So after the demise of the union unit, which we feel is probably gone for good, but no one will quite say, there's a chance that it might pop up again, perhaps in the background. What you're having instead, or at least for the time being, is the Prime Minister chairing a new cabinet committee on the union. And the people attending that will be Michael Gove, it will be Alistair Jack, the Scotland Secretary. It will be Simon Hart, the Wales Secretary. And David Frost will be there. And also Brandon Lewis, the Northern Ireland Secretary. So I think you can see that this could start to have an impact too. It's not just going to be about Scottish independence, even though in a way that is the main focus right now in terms of where the debate is. You can see that this will also influence the Northern Ireland approach.
Katie and James, thanks very much. And you can hear more about Katie's piece if you watch Spectator TV out this evening at 6 p.m. on YouTube. So just go to the Spectator's YouTube channel to find that. Thanks to all of you who've written in about our summer party for listeners. I think it's definitely going to go ahead. You don't have to agree with Fraser Nelson in order to come, as some of you have emailed and it seemed like you thought you might have to do that. But we'll let you know more details in due course. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.